Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
It's no secret the Pentagon's wartime budget is now funding a lot of day-to-day requirements, but DoD accounting systems can't tell how much. New estimates from the Government Accountability Office say DoD has routinely dipped into its overseas contingency operations account to fund enduring requirements, and they've been doing it since 2009. But there's no way to tell which account ultimately funded any particular expense, and that makes it difficult for Congress to oversee DoD's operations and maintenance accounts. Andrew Von Ahr is GAO's Acting Director for Defense Capabilities and Management. He spoke with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu about the O&M accounting problem.
Operation and maintenance obligations were higher than enacted amounts in every year. And this is something that DoD did within its authorities to transfer and reprogram dollars to do that.
And that gets to some of the core of this report. Those actual base obligations that you report are GAO's estimates. They're not figures that DoD tracks or reports. So talk to us about why they don't track that and why it matters.
Well, they're unable to track those numbers basically because their financial systems are outdated. This has been something that's been on our high-risk list for over a decade. And they are in the process of updating their financial systems. But all of these accounts in the operation and maintenance appropriations fund, it's a number of different accounts, and they're all sort of on different systems. And so it's very labor-intensive and time-consuming to piece together exactly what all of the base obligations are.
Mm-hmm. And just to make things a little more complicated, I think there's at least a couple ways in which OCO money might get used for things that really are base requirements. If I'm understanding the process right, you know, in one case, you could have Congress intentionally appropriating OCO money for base requirements in a given budget year, and then you have the reprogrammings that you talked about, right?
That's absolutely right. And really the concern we have and the concern that our requesters had, the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, was about the sustainability of what DoD's budget here. You know, the actual dollars are higher in every year across operation and maintenance base obligations. And some of it is coming from OCO, and there's, you know, money goes back and forth through a number of different accounts. And so, you know, there is a question about whether DoD is accurately conveying to Congress what its enduring activities and needs are, and whether Congress has the information available to it to appropriately plan for DoD spending.
If at least some of this, though, is happening with Congress's eyes wide open and they are knowingly using some OCO money for base requirements, what's the concern? Is it just that OCO at some point may no longer be available, and then you have that stability problem that you referenced?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a concern really that, you know, DoD is paying for things that are enduring activities out of things that are meant for contingencies, and so that's really the sort of the heart of what we're concerned about here. And we're also concerned that, you know, DoD doesn't have effective financial management systems to track their spending at a granular level. So that leaves DoD and Congress guessing when it comes to how much the department will need from year to year.
Right. To some extent, you know, I guess you need some level of flexibility to deal with changing scenarios in the operating environment and unexpected needs. What's the right way to think about balancing that, you know, with a solid and executable budget that Congress can oversee properly?
Well, one of the things that we found in our work was that in some of the budget categories, there was a consistent pattern of over-obligation from year to year. So this is something that in base operating support, administrative and management functions, and in mobilization and those specific sub-activity groups, every year it was over-obligated by, you know, many millions of dollars. And I think over the seven-year period for base operating support, for example, it was just about $18 billion. DoD is aware of that this is sort of a consistent issue and, you know, is working to, you know, sort of recalibrate its plans, you know, in light of the fact that they over-obligate in these areas from year to year. So it's looking for those kinds of patterns where, you know, this is clearly an enduring activity because every year they over-obligate it.
And if DoD can't tell us whether a particular piece of spending ultimately got funded through OCO or funded through base, that's probably also a problem for auditability, isn't it?
It is, and DoD is, you know, taking a number of actions to get to audit readiness, and GAO has been making recommendations to them for many years about improving their financial systems and their financial reporting, financial management, to get to that point where they are ready for audit.
You've touched on this already, but let's talk about what GAO's actual recommendations in this area are, and what DoD's reply was.
Sure. So we recommended that DoD essentially be able to report to Congress what its base obligations are ultimately at a granular level, so that Congress can, you know, look at those different categories and see exactly where DoD is consistently or not consistently over-obligating or under-obligating. DoD's response, they did not concur with that recommendation, stating that their financial systems really don't allow them to do so, and that it's labor-intensive and time-consuming for them to be able to do it by hand. They did cite in their response that they are improving their financial systems, and we have seen some improvement in their financial systems over time, and we're hoping that over time, that as they improve their financial systems, we would hope that this kind of reporting would be something that they would be able to do.
And you mentioned earlier, Andrew, that there are some cases where DoD is consistently over-obligating in a particular account or for a particular piece of expenditure. Have they indicated to you that they are planning on moving those things into base? And I don't know if off the top of your head you know what some of those consistencies are.
So those areas were administrative and management functions, base operating support, and mobilization. Those were the three sub-activity groups where we saw consistent over-obligation. They are aware of those consistent patterns. They have taken steps, they told us, to better align their request with the requirements. And we'll, you know, that's yet to be seen whether that changes the situation in the future. Part of the issue here is DoD sort of planning for future years as well. And as they have been planning in their five-year, future year, you know, defense program, they've been adjusting that downward every year. And so ultimately what we see is they've reached a point now where they don't feel like they can adjust things downward any further. And when you sort of look at what they planned for, what Congress enacted, and what they ultimately obligated, what was enacted was always less than they planned for, and what they obligated was always more than what was enacted. So what you see really is ultimately is DoD is not planning particularly well from year to year for these largest accounts, and has typically thought it can do more with less. But it's reached a point now where they're now adjusting those plans upward in the out years.
Andrew Van Aa is Acting Director for Defense Capabilities and Management at the Government Accountability Office. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
For nearly 10 years, the Defense Information Systems Agency has been working to provide secure cloud computing to DoD agencies. No longer the exclusive cloud provider itself, DISA now helps agencies use commercial cloud providers in a secure way. Nowadays, much of the effort centers on applications, if they're ready for cloud hosting, and the best way to go about it. Joining me with more, John Hale, the Cloud Portfolio Manager at DISA. John, good to have you on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, give us an overview of what DISA is planning on doing vis-a-vis the cloud for the next year or so in fiscal 2017 and beyond.
Sure. So I will start by saying it's a very exciting time within the Department of Defense as far as cloud computing goes. This has kind of announced our three-prong approach towards cloud computing going forward. So number one is, and people don't like me to say it, but cloud is not the savior of everything. So we see traditional data centers and traditional compute going forward as one prong of that approach. The second one is we're doing our MilCloud 2.0 RFP right now, which is going to bring a commercial cloud provider on premise and deliver cloud capabilities to the department from our facilities. So the idea is the department's going to provide that particular provider ping, pad, and power, and they're going to provide services to the rest of the department from our data centers. So they're going to be able to provide those secure services native to our network. And the third thing is we've been offering the cloud access point, which allows secure use of commercial off-prem cloud for a while. But we're actually expanding that capability going forward over the next year with a service that we call SCCA, the Secure Cloud Computing Architecture. And SCCA is going to provide not only the cloud access point, but also a set of secure services so that our DoD mission partners can more safely and securely leverage off-prem commercial cloud going forward.
Let's talk a little bit about MilCloud, the RFP. Will that be, would it be fair to call that a contractor-owned and government-operated, or is it the opposite, or how would you describe it?
No, so actually we're looking at the MilCloud 2.0 as being a contractor-owned and contractor-operated capability. It will just be running in a government facility. So the idea is that we're going to bring a commercial cloud provider in and treat it almost like a black box, and they're going to do what they do in their existing commercial facilities for commercial partners. They're just simply going to do it from our facility and for DoD mission partners.
And that raises a question about the traditional data centers that you say will be still continue to be a part of DoD computing, as I think they are, will be across the whole federal government. And that is, as those data centers get modernized, will they be modernized in a way that makes them look more like clouds?
Well, I believe they will. I mean, ultimately, as we shift more and more workload to the cloud-type model, I think you're going to see more data centers basically. The walls, for lack of a better word, will be broken down, and it'll be more of an internal DoD cloud amongst all of our existing facilities. So I think you're going to see that modernization going forward across the board.
I guess if you want to have the ultimate in scalability, then the COCO MilCloud, if it has the same architecture and network set up as the as DISA's own data centers and DoD's own data centers, then if everyone operates the same way, it would be easier to have that full cloud capability?
Absolutely. You know, the thing is if you look at commercial capabilities today, if you look at a commercial service that everybody uses on a day-to-day basis, and you ask an average user where is their data housed, an average user has no idea. And that's the whole beauty of cloud is, you know, the applications can move around and shift from facility to facility based on needs of the network and needs of the system. And the end user has basically no idea where the actual data is being housed.
And let's talk about applications for a moment. I know that many agencies, especially in DoD, are kind of figuring out what applications can be hosted in a cloud, in a government cloud. What are, in general, the types of advice you offer?
Well, I will tell you that a lot of our mission partners look at cloud as a huge cost savings from their existing applications. So they have this idea that if they do a lift and shift, if they just pick up what's running in their existing data centers today and they move it to the commercial cloud, that they're going to reap a large amount of resource savings. And in reality, what we found is really the best way to recoup that cost savings is to rebuild your applications in a cloud environment from the beginning. So if an application is designed and built to leverage the cloud and to leverage the efficiencies and capabilities and elasticity that the cloud provides, that's where you're going to get more reward for your effort.
We're speaking with John Hale, the Cloud Portfolio Manager at the Defense Information Systems Agency. What about the issue of service level agreements? I know that a lot of agencies struggle with what do you put in them or how do you fashion them such that the cloud provider wants to be your provider and also that the government gets what it needs.
So, you know, the thing is from a Department of Defense perspective, to use a commercial cloud provider, they have to go through the FedRAMP process. And then after FedRAMP, we also have a set of additional levels that they have to meet, security levels that they have to meet to house DoD data. As part of that process, we grant them a provisional authorization. And I will tell you that in the future going forward, we're looking at standardizing the SLAs as part of that process. Now, right now, we don't have that. So every time we do an agreement with a mission partner, we're coordinating an SLA. But when we do that SLA, that SLA is standard across the rest of the department. So every mission partner who's leveraging that commercial provider is on the same SLA.
And will the SLA differ for the MilCloud, or will it have the same basic parameters?
So the plan is for our SLA for MilCloud to basically be the same SLA that the commercial provider would provide in their off-prem solution. So whatever availability requirement that they have in their off-prem solution would be the same type of availability requirement that we will offer as our on-prem capability.
And so for a defense agency to use an off-prem or a commercial cloud, do they go through DISA now? How does that all work?
So they don't necessarily go through DISA from a contracting and funding perspective. The connection from their existing facility to that commercial cloud provider does go through the DISA run cloud access point, which is basically the security boundary between the DOTA and the Department of Defense Information Network and the commercial cloud providers.
So that's the place or the locus at which the requirements that are beyond FedRAMP get implemented, sounds like.
Exactly.
So on the security front then, agencies in DOD that want to go through that access point, if they accept the SLA and accept the parameters of the access point, they don't really need to do any further work in terms of the supplier's security capabilities.
Correct. I mean, when a cloud service provider achieves a provisional authorization, that's basically an independent organization asserting that that cloud service provider is certified to handle data up to a particular level, whether it be levels 3 or level 5, according to the cloud security requirements guide that DOD's published. And so once that service providers achieve that provisional authorization, then the mission partner only has to worry about their actual application, because that's basically saying that the infrastructure is certified to handle that particular service level.
So you don't really personally at DISA care which applications go to the cloud, as long as the connection and the SLA and the cloud provider used conform to DISA's security requirements.
Correct. As an evangelist for cloud within the department, one of my things is I like to tell mission partners they should move as much as possible to the cloud from a cost and resource savings perspective. But with that said, you're absolutely correct. You know, from a DISA really doesn't have a true stake in the ground as far as which applications move from a DOD mission partner to the commercial cloud. I would like for all of them to move.
And what is the timeline for MilCloud at this point? Where do you stand in the RFP, and when would you hope to award it?
So the RFP should close later this month, and the plan is for the award to happen basically around September, October timeframe.
And this will be a single company award?
The initial implementation of MilCloud 2.0 will be a single vendor award. And based on how that progresses, we may open that up to multiple vendors going forward.
I mean, given the legacy of the mega centers, there must be plenty of physical space for a second or third MilCloud provider.
There is. I mean, from a facility perspective, I don't think, bringing in two or three different providers may not be a physical issue. We just need to make sure that we get the first one right, and then we can use that model for the rest of them.
John Hale is the Cloud Portfolio Manager at the Defense Information Systems Agency. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.